Nemoto presents scientific giants. Rosalind Franklin, the woman in the diffraction pattern. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 11 minutes. You're listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed the World. Each episode stands beside one mind and follows a thread of curiosity until it ties to the world we inhabit. Today we meet a scientist whose evidence was so sharp that it cut through one of biology's greatest mysteries, and yet the fame attached to that mystery settled elsewhere. Her name is Rosalind Franklin, and her story is not only about DNA. It is about the conditions under which truth is produced, and the social structure that decides who becomes visible when truth arrives. Rosalind Franklin was born in 1920 in London into a well-to-do and intellectually serious family. From early on, she had the temperament that makes a certain kind of science possible. She did not accept vague answers. She had a hard clarity, a disciplined insistence that you earn every conclusion with method. In a culture that often rewarded charm and social ease, she had something different, an internal exactness that could feel abrasive to people who preferred smoother talk. She studied at Cambridge during World War II, a period when life was shaped by rationing, bombing, and a pervasive sense of emergency. Scientific research in Britain was not an ivory tower pursuit, it was entangled with national survival. Franklin began with work that might sound far from the double helix: coal and carbon. She studied the microstructure of coal, how pores and layers behaved, how heat changed arrangement. It was practical research with industrial relevance, but it trained her in something crucial: the ability to infer structure from indirect evidence. You could not see the internal arrangement of carbon directly. You had to build a picture from patterns, from scattering, from careful interpretation. This habit, treating data like a language with strict grammar, would define her later work. After the war, she went to Paris and worked at the Laboratoire Central des Services Chimiques de l'État, where she learned X-ray crystallography in a culture that, by many accounts, felt more collegial and less rigidly hierarchical than what she later encountered in London. X-ray crystallography is one of the great interpretive arts of modern science. You shine X-rays at a crystalline or semi-crystalline material, and the atoms scatter the rays into a pattern. The pattern is not a photograph, it is a code. To read it requires mathematical translation and experimental discipline. The quality of the result depends on sample preparation, exposure timing, alignment, humidity, patience. It rewards those who can tolerate slow perfection. Franklin became exceptional at this. She could produce images that were not just data but arguments. In 1951, she arrived at King's College London to work in a lab focused on DNA. At that time, DNA was known to be involved in heredity, but its structure was not understood. People argued about whether it was the primary genetic material or whether proteins held that honor. The problem of structure was not a decorative detail, it was the key to function. If you could find the shape, you could begin to see how information might be stored and copied. King's College had its own internal climate, both literal and social. The DNA research there involved Maurice Wilkins and others, and Franklin's arrival did not settle into a smooth partnership. There were misunderstandings about roles and responsibilities. There were cultural tensions. There was, plainly, the force of gender in a scientific institution still shaped by assumptions about who belonged where. Franklin was not treated simply as a colleague. She was treated as a complication. Yet she worked. She focused on producing the best diffraction patterns possible. DNA, unlike a simple crystal, was tricky. It could exist in different forms depending on hydration. Franklin distinguished between these forms, often called A and B forms, and she understood that the difference mattered. Water content changed the structure, and if you didn't control humidity, you didn't know which structure you were seeing. This might sound like a technical footnote. It is not. It is the difference between guessing and knowing. Her most famous achievement in this context is an image known as Photo 51. The name makes it sound like a casual snapshot. It was not. It was a diffraction photograph of the B form of DNA taken under carefully controlled conditions. The pattern contained a clear X-shaped cross, a signature of a helical structure. It also contained quantitative information about the dimensions, the spacing between repeating units, the diameter, the pitch. It was the kind of evidence that does not merely suggest a helix, it practically demands one. Franklin did not stop at, "It's a helix." She pursued the details with caution. She worked to calculate parameters, to test which assumptions matched the pattern, to keep her conclusions inside the strict boundaries of what the data allowed. She was close. Very close. She wrote reports and notes that show she understood key aspects of the structure, including the likelihood that the sugar phosphate backbone lay on the outside, not the inside. She was doing what she always did, making sure the argument was earned. Meanwhile, in Cambridge, James Watson and Francis Crick were building models. Their approach was different. They were less patient with pure data and more willing to speculate, to arrange pieces and see what could fit. Model building can be a powerful method. It can also become a form of aesthetic gamble. Watson and Crick needed constraints, and the sharpest constraints came from the best diffraction data. This is where the story becomes ethically charged. Franklin's data and analysis were not fully under her control in how they circulated. Information moved through informal channels. Photo 51 was shown to Watson without Franklin's direct consent, and a report containing Franklin's measurements was shared in ways that blurred the boundaries of propriety. The exact details of who knew what and when have been debated, but the core reality is hard to escape. Franklin's work substantially informed the model that became famous, while her name did not appear at the center of the story when the Nobel Prize later recognized the discovery. Watson and Crick published the double helix model in 1953. It was brilliant. It also depended on the kind of empirical rigor Franklin embodied. The double helix was not just a shape. It was an explanation of replication. Complementary base pairing meant that each strand could serve as a template. Structure and function snapped together like two parts of a single sentence. Franklin's own papers were published in the same issue of Nature, providing crucial experimental support. Yet in public memory, she was often reduced to a supporting character in someone else's triumph. There is a cruel irony here. Science likes to pretend it is a pure meritocracy of ideas. But science is done by humans inside institutions with status structures, with informal networks, with biases that shape what is noticed and what is discounted. Franklin's story is not an exception. It is a clear case where the social world and the intellectual world overlapped, and where the overlap mattered. Franklin left King's College and moved to Birkbeck College, where she did extraordinary work on viruses, including the tobacco mosaic virus and polio-related structures. Her scientific life did not end with DNA. In some ways, her later work shows what she might have become in the long arc of structural biology had she lived longer. But she did not live longer. She died in 1958 at the age of 37, likely from ovarian cancer, possibly related to years of X-ray exposure in an era when safety standards were less developed and less strictly enforced. The basement lab with dangerous X-rays is not a metaphor. It was her daily environment. She worked in conditions that demanded physical risk as part of intellectual pursuit, and she paid a price. When the Nobel Prize for the Structure of DNA was awarded in 1962, it went to Watson, Crick, and Wilkins. Nobel Prizes are not awarded posthumously, so Franklin could not have received it even if the committee had wanted to correct the imbalance. But the fact remains, the public story hardened around the names that received the prize, and Franklin's role became, for many years, a footnote. Then the footnote began to speak. Historians, scientists, and readers looked more carefully. They found not only that Franklin's data was essential, but that her intellectual contribution was deep. She was not merely a technician who produced a useful photograph. She was a structural thinker who knew how to extract meaning from diffraction patterns with disciplined restraint. She understood the grammar of evidence. So how should we remember Rosalind Franklin? We should remember her as a maker of constraints. The double helix model did not emerge from imagination alone. It emerged because the data cornered reality into a narrow set of possibilities. Franklin's work did that cornering. She forced nature to confess its geometry. We should remember her as a scientist whose rigor was, in itself, a kind of courage, because it is harder to say, not yet, than it is to say, I think so. And she kept herself honest even when the race pressured people toward faster claims. We should also remember her as a mirror held up to scientific culture. Her story asks an uncomfortable question: how many discoveries are remembered as the work of a few named geniuses, when in fact they were built from a landscape of labor, and from contributions that were not equally rewarded? Franklin's life reminds us that discovery has a social history, and that the ethics of credit are part of the ethics of science. If you want a final image, picture the diffraction photograph itself, a dark field with a bright X, like a hidden structure insisting on being known. Franklin saw that insistence and followed it with discipline. The world saw it too, eventually. But the delay matters because it reveals how recognition is not always synchronized with truth. You've been listening to Scientific Giants Who Changed the World. Today we followed Rosalind Franklin into the basement laboratory where X-rays became a language, where humidity and patience shaped an image that contained the geometry of heredity. In our next episode we will meet Fritz Haber, a chemist whose work fed billions by pulling nitrogen from the air, and yet also opened the door to chemical warfare, an example of discovery's double edge sharpened to a terrifying point. Until then, thank you for your attention and your time. This episode was written as a continuous story for the ear, because Franklin's life cannot be honored as a slogan. It has to be experienced as a sequence of choices, constraints, and consequences, until you feel how a pattern on film can carry both truth and tragedy.